But first, the murder of a Central California police officer is escalating the immigration debate. Investigators say the suspect was in the country illegally. A manhunt is currently underway for the suspect, who police believe is still in the area of Central California. Police Corporal Roneel Singh was shot and killed during a traffic stop just hours after Christmas. President Trump mentioned the killing on Twitter yesterday, stating, "Time to get tough on border security, build the wall." CBS's Maria Villarreal reports from police headquarters in Newman, California.
The sheriff tells us they have teams of law enforcement agencies right now tracking down every possible lead to find this suspect. Officer Roneel was one of 13 police officers here at Newman and the first ever to be killed in the line of duty.
My department is hurting. We're struggling through this. We're a family. We're not an agency. We're a family.
Newman, California Police Chief Randy Richardson made a tearful plea for the public's help in finding the man they say is responsible for the murder of Corporal Roneel Singh. The officer had pulled over a gray Dodge truck for suspected DUI early Wednesday morning.
There was. It was a gunfight. Corporal Singh absolutely tried to defend himself and stop this credible threat.
Singh was hit several times and later died at the hospital. County Sheriff Adam Christensen says they're now looking for this unnamed suspect seen here in surveillance and social media photos. Deputies served a search warrant in this nearby mobile home park and towed away the suspect's truck.
We are actively pursuing every investigative lead. We have spared no expense.
Christensen says the suspect was in the country illegally. 7 months ago, the sheriff met with President Trump and other law enforcement officials to express his support for cracking down on illegal immigrants who break the law.
There should be no interference in our ability to protect our communities.
But for now, the Newman community is focused on honoring Singh's legacy. The canine officer leaves behind a wife and young son.
This five-month-old, he will never hear talk. He doesn't get to hold that little boy, hug his wife, because a coward took his life.
The county has set up a memorial fund in honor of Corporal Singh, and tonight the community will gather together here in downtown Newman for a vigil, again, in his honor as well.
That is Maria Villarreal from Newman, California. Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen plans to visit immigration facilities on the U.S.-Mexico border later today. That follows the death of two migrant children in U.S. Customs and Border Protection custody this month. An autopsy on an 8-year-old who died on Christmas Eve shows he had the flu. He was only diagnosed with a cold and fever, though. Janet Shomlian reports for CBS from El Paso, Texas, which faces another growing problem in the immigration struggle.
The numbers are truly overwhelming. More than 100,000 migrants have been detained at the border in just the past 2 months, and thousands of them, once they're freed, are being dropped off here at the El Paso bus station with very few resources. Amid concerns for their care, we're now hearing from the mother of that little boy who died while in U.S. custody.
The mother of 8-year-old Felipe Gomez Alonso, who died Christmas Eve in the custody of U.S. Border Security, wants her son's body returned home to Guatemala. I need help to bring my son so that I can be at peace, she said, and so that this sadness in my heart can pass. She said she had hoped her son and his father would be granted asylum in the U.S. A government autopsy shows Felipe had the flu when he died Monday night, less than 3 weeks after 7-year-old Guatemala native Jacqueline Call died from dehydration and septic shock. Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen appeared on Capitol Hill earlier this month following Call's death.
Our goal is always to take care of those in our custody.
Nielsen plans to get a firsthand view of the medical screenings and facilities when she visits the U.S.-Mexico border today and tomorrow.
One of the migrants who got off the bus was a family, young family, a mother and a young son, 7 or 8 years old, clearly dehydrated. He had feverish symptoms. He had a high temperature.
Dylan Corbett helps people seeking asylum until they're able to connect with relatives in the U.S. He says they've been swamped with thousands of hopeful migrants dropped off at bus stations with no food, clothes, or shelter.
Folks just need their basic needs taken care of. They need to understand where they are in the immigration system. They need help making their journey to their next destination.
Those charitable shelters that house many of these families once they're released are now at capacity. This is truly a growing crisis because the number of migrants arriving at the U.S. border from those caravans is only expected to surge in the coming weeks, and there's no place for them to go.
That's Janet Shamlian reporting for CBS from El Paso, Texas. You're listening to Seattle's Morning News with Dave Ross, who has some time off. I'm Colleen O'Brien, and Hannah Scott is joining us in the studio this morning. The countdown to the Seattle squeeze is on, just 14 days to go until the Alaskan Way Viaduct closes. That closure expected to wreak havoc for commuters all across the region. And so Hannah's here with what the city of Seattle is doing and what they hope you will do to help soften the blow of this closure. Hannah?
The overall message?
It's going to be horrible for pretty much everyone, unless we can figure out some small changes we can all make.
City Council Member Mike O'Brien says the city is doing all it can to make sure everyone is, first of all, aware of what's coming.
Currently, almost 90,000 vehicles a day use that viaduct. And after work on January 11th, that thing is going to be closed for good. And the tunnel's not going to open for 3 weeks. So those 90,000 vehicles are going to go somewhere. And that's going to have a ripple effect on our entire region.
And he says that means not just those people who normally use 99.
Obviously, if you're someone who uses 99 right now, you're going to have to think directly, what do you do differently? But a lot of those vehicles will go to I-5. I-5 is already overcrowded, so some vehicles on I-5 will move to 405.
O'Brien says that means this will be felt across the Sound, everywhere from surface streets to freeways. So they're asking everyone to really take a very serious look at what they can do differently during those 3 weeks.
If you're driving a car, especially to downtown Seattle, if there's any way you can get downtown without driving alone, we really ask you to consider trying some alternatives. So that might mean taking transit. It might mean carpooling or vanpooling with someone. It might mean working from home for some of the day. Maybe you're just telecommuting for a little bit and driving downtown on an off hour.
And he says we're not just talking about asking drivers to make changes.
Our transit system during rush hour is already really crowded. And so even if you're someone who already takes transit downtown, but you're commuting during peak rush hour, we're asking if there's any way you could shift your commute a little earlier or a little later to create a little more space on those buses and trains.
And O'Brien says this is going to be a very fluid situation for the city, especially when we're talking about transit and transit-only lanes.
We're going to be watching routes, and if what we see is, Third Avenue is pretty good. I don't think we're going to make changes there one way or the other. But on some of the other streets where buses run, you know, if on 4th Avenue what we're seeing in the afternoon commute is buses are being delayed an additional 5 or 10 minutes, we may look about using cones to add an additional bus lane to get them through, because that's, adding more capacity for a handful of people in cars or adding some more capacity, reallocating capacity for thousands of people on a bus, we're going to get more bang for the buck on the bus.
Now, I should point out that includes the possibility of creating with cones or some kind of temporary fixture all new transit-only lanes. So that's something to keep an eye on for commuters. Now, as for biking as an alternative?
Biking?
Yeah.
Biking and walking are both great options. Now, I'm a daily bike commuter. I should probably be mostly fine on this. So, you know, if you've never bike commuted before, the first time in a cold, wet January evening is probably not the best time to start. But if you're already a bike commuter and you're a kind of fair-weather commuter, you do it in the summer and spring, think about getting some gear and trying it, you know, one day a week. I mean, look at that weather forecast. We get windows, and so if there's going to be a nice day, you know, commit to saying, I'm going to try a January bike ride on a good day. I already have some of the gear. I'll make that work.
So you're absolutely right. The day that I talked to him, actually, he biked to downtown the day before, and it was pouring rain that day, and he said it was awful. It was miserable.
He does realize how many suburbanites come into Seattle to work, though, correct?
I mean,
let's be real.
Sometimes
you get in the Seattle bubble, and you forget. You got daycare, you got school drop off, it's unrealistic. So the carpool thing, sure. I think that if you're an employer, you're an HR manager and you're not talking about what you can do for your employees, you're behind the curve. You better start talking now because it can be a tough thing to come to your boss and say, hey, can I telecommute? Or, hey, is there an alternative? So you as the employer have to take the responsibility and say, let's do something for our employees that might have a tough time
getting
in. Absolutely.
And the city is absolutely making that call to employers. They've already worked out and been meeting with a lot of our larger companies, Amazon, all of our tech companies, and a lot of those employees already do telecommute.
Yeah.
The city is also letting as many of its staff telecommute as possible. And to your point, O'Brien says the city does understand that not everyone is going to be able to shift their routine here.
And so for those people that can't change, we're asking everyone else that has some flexibility to really stretch yourself and try to find something new.
And I want to stress, and he wanted to stress, this is not about telling people not to come to Seattle.
You know, we don't want to shut down the commerce in Seattle. You know, people are working here. It's still going to be vibrant. But we are saying, like, hey, if you're taking a discretionary trip, you know, if you're running downtown to do some shopping, do it outside the rush hour window if you can.
So, again, just kind of putting everything out there.
I have to break it to him, not to be too much of a cynic, but people aren't coming to Seattle not just because there's traffic.
Well,
like, I'm just going to make a...
There's a lot
like a
going
day
on.
Day trip to downtown to do some shopping.
I know, right? My daughter asked me to do that over the holiday. I said, I'm not doing it.
No, thanks.
Nope. A couple of things, though, to remember. So, moving forward, I was also at a press briefing right before the holiday with Mayor Durkin and Seattle transportation officials. And the overall message from the city here is, okay, this may be a 3-week closure, but this is about the new normal. They are actively trying to keep people out of the, you know, single occupancy vehicles. They're going to be focusing more on transit. Mayor Jenny Durkin outlined that she was going to be asking the state legislature for some changes in rules to have more cameras in there to make sure for bike lanes, right? So that you can bust people for breaking the rules in bike lanes, for transit only lanes and things like that.
And so, let's not forget that you're right, that this is about the new normal, because even when the viaduct shuts down and 3 weeks later the tunnel opens to traffic, it won't be the same.
No.
There are no downtown exits for the tunnel. So it's not like those viaduct commuters will then shift back to the tunnel because they can't get to where they were going in the first place when they took the viaduct. They can get through Seattle, but not to Seattle. So I-5 will continue to feel the pinch even after the tunnel opens.
And I think that's the overall message that we're getting from all of the city leaders, is that you are absolutely never going to be commuting the same way that you were before the viaduct closure.
Isn't
it's just
fun?
All different.
I mean, I'm happy that the project is nearly complete, because it's 3 years behind schedule as it is, but no downtown exits. It just seems to me that what's the point? Other than getting a pretty waterfront view.
It is going to be a bit. Absolutely.
You know, something fun that is going on, not to be, like I said, I'm not trying to get down on everything. I just want to be realistic. I think a lot of people still don't realize the tunnel has no downtown exits. You keep hearing that. Like, wait, what?
Wait, no, I know.
Is you can actually do an 8K on the viaduct before it shuts down. They're doing that on February 2nd at 7:30 a.m. You can walk or run the 8K if you'd like. But it gives you a chance to really walk across the viaduct, take a look at the iconic structure. Take a look at the waterfront view, which has some of the best views.
It is. It's absolutely
beautiful. It's a distracting
beautiful.
Drive.
Absolutely
and beautiful. You also get to walk through the tunnel during this 8K. So, I know.
I'm not going to lie. It creeps me out. But
a little claustrophobic. But it's something fun, maybe celebratory. So, thank you for that, Hannah.
Absolutely.
And, of course, Chiral Radio is going to be on top of what we've tongue-in-cheek called it via doom, as it does shut down the night of January 11th. Chris Sullivan, Tracy Taylor, our traffic reporters, of course, Hannah Scott. We're going to be on top of all the different angles as far as traffic mitigation, telecommuting. What does happen once the tunnel opens, those viaduct commuters make or do not make that shift to the tunnel? So we'll stay on top of it for you here on Chiral Radio. As for It's time for our Sports Insider from 710 ESPN Seattle, brought to you by Western Washington Toyota Dealers. It's Danny O'Neill from Danny, Dave, and Moore. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing all right. So the Huskies, our alma mater, going to the Rose Bowl.
I'm pretty excited. I will be there. I think I'm landing on January 1st.
Oh, you're going?
7:30. Heck yeah.
Oh, look at you. Is it work-related or
no,
just fan-related?
It's fan-related.
I'm proud of you.
Yeah, I love Washington football, and I've made a vow that anytime they're going to the Rose Bowl, I'm going to be there. I'm going to, when they go to the Rose Bowl.
How many times have they been?
Twice.
Oh.
Since I was at school.
So it's a big commitment, Danny.
The other time, though, I was on strike and in Hawaii.
What do you mean on strike and in Hawaii?
Well, I was on strike, but then went in vacation to Hawaii with my family and then came back to go to the Rose Bowl. Yeah.
You're deeply committed. I need to be a better Husky alumni, I guess.
Well, I don't know about being on strike and going to Hawaii if that's deeply committed.
That's true. So
I left the picket line to go to the beach, Colleen. That was kind of pathetic.
That's all right. It's the beach. It calls you. Boy, now that makes me want to go to Hawaii. Okay, maybe in 2019. So set up the Rose Bowl for me again. Who are they playing? What are the prospects? All of that.
They're playing Ohio State, which is thoroughly detestable for two reasons. First of all, they have the unmitigated hubris to refer to themselves as the Ohio State University.
Huh?
As if there are so many state universities in Ohio that we would get confused. Yes, they call themselves the Ohio State
University. We call ourselves the University of Washington.
Well, we don't put the emphasis on the article.
They do that. They go the Ohio State University.
Yes, as if it's the Ohio.
Yeah, that's annoying.
Yeah, yeah. It's and then the other thing is they've got a complete egotist and enabler of domestic violence in Urban Meyer.
Oh, no.
And this is his last game as a head coach. So I'd like to send him out on his keystone.
Remind me of the Urban Meyer storyline.
He had the assistant coach named Zach Smith.
Yes, yes.
Whom he knew had been alerted from both a previous police investigation into his coach's behavior and then that coach's wife telling his wife that there had been abuse, which he did not follow up with in the way that he says he did what he should, which was tell his athletic director. When asked about it, he then denied any knowledge of this past police investigation into the actions of his assistant coach. Mm-hmm. And then it came back and bit him in the butt and he got suspended.
And the assistant coach is gone.
The assistant coach is gone. Urban served a 3-game suspension, is now pretending he's some sort of martyr, and he's not going to coach anymore. But next quarter at Ohio State, he's teaching some class about integrity and leadership.
What?
Yeah. You can't make this stuff
at
up.
The Ohio State University?
Yes, that's
oh,
correct.
I should sign up for the online course so that I'd love to sit.
I'm the hypocrite at the Ohio State University.
So we really want to beat them then?
Yes.
Many reasons to be. Can we?
Yes. Yes, we can.
Yeah?
Yes, we can.
Well, okay, but give me the Sports Insider analysis.
The Sports Insider is that I'm surprised it's only a 7-point spread, that Ohio State isn't favored by more. They've got one loss. We're probably the first team left out of the college football playoff.
Okay.
And Washington has lost 3 different times and has been decidedly uneven in its performances. But I believe in the Huskies.
Yeah, me too.
I believe in Chris Peterson getting a month to prepare. I believe in the fact that they've got 2 of their best players back. I'm excited.
Let's go for it. But before the Rose Bowl, we've got the Alamo Bowl.
Yes.
Which is Wazoo.
The Cougs.
Yes.
Do you think that's fitting?
No, they're not playing.
Do you think it's fitting that they're at the Alamo?
Why
like
would that
the last
be fitting?
Band. Well, I don't know. Did anybody survive the Alamo?
I see where you're going there. I'm like, what is it? The location? Is it dry and deserty?
They were praised for their fortitude in a losing effort.
I get it.
Sounds like the Cougs.
But we're not playing them, so don't you want them to win? Wouldn't you root for your stepbrother?
Yeah. Yes. I don't want anybody to beat up our little brother except for us. But if they lost, I'd kind of giggle, too.
No, you say little brother. I said stepbrother. Is there a difference in affection there that you're labeling it little brother?
No. No, I don't think there is. Okay. I just think of them as they're our little brother.
Who are they playing?
They're playing Iowa State.
Iowa State.
Yeah. Which, Iowa, doesn't that sound like something you'd say if you got hit? Iowa! As opposed to a state? Iowa!
Iowa! Ohio! That's what I think of. Is Wazoo going to win that one?
I do think they're going to win it, although Mike Leach's bowl record is awful. It's terrible. I think he's won one bowl game.
Wouldn't it be great as we exit this year and enter the new year if Wazoo could win, the Huskies could win, and the Seahawks could win?
I love your undefeatable optimism.
I'm a cheerleader for life.
You want everybody to be happy.
I do.
Yeah, I don't mind if a little misery falls in there. Hey, I think they'll win, and if they don't, it's no skin off my back.
That's true. You just need the Huskies to win. And no matter what, the Seahawks are going to the playoffs.
Yeah, that's correct.
Is the pressure off, or do we really want to grind Arizona into
yes,
the dirt?
Yes, you want to grind Arizona into the dirt. They have not.
If we don't, though, you're not going to go, uh-oh.
The season's not lost, but here's the thing you're rooting for, consistency. This team needs to find a consistency it has not shown yet this year. They've shown they can beat and contend with any of the best teams in the league. Can they be consistent?
Danny O'Neill, thank you.
Thanks, Colleen.
Our Sports Insider brought to you by Western Washington Toyota Dealers.
Seattle's Morning News, Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. And joining us, movie man Michael Medved with a movie called If Beale Street Could Talk. Should we recognize what Beale Street is?
the film refers to the Beale Street in New Orleans. It's a 1974 novel by James Baldwin. And I do think the film is going to be handicapped by its title. It's one of those titles that you can't really figure it out. And because the novel was acclaimed and James Baldwin is such an iconic novelist, they have left the title. But it really tells you nothing about the movie. What the movie is about a young couple deeply involved in Harlem in the 1970s. And he is wrongly accused of rape. And after he is placed in prison and his entire extended family and family are trying their very best to try to get him out, his young lover finds out she's pregnant. Mm-hmm. And it's about the struggles for the baby and to get this young man out of prison. Now, the film is redeemed, and I think it's slow-moving. It is artistic. I should say it's directed by Barry Jenkins, who's a very gifted director who did Moonlight. And he wrote and directed this film, and it is a loving adaptation. I went back and looked at the novel, and the film follows the novel very closely and I think captures the novel's spirit very effectively. And this really is a tragedy. It's not quite a Romeo and Juliet tragedy, because the families in this film actually come together to try to save the young man from the toils of implacable racism. Mm-hmm. And the young man is played, it's a truly remarkable performance by a young actor named Stephan James. And Kiki Layne is luminous, playing his fiance.
Sorry, baby. I didn't mean none of that for you. I love you. You know that.
I do. And I understand what you're going through, because I'm with you.
The things that tormented me the most were the very things that connected me with all the people who were alive.
The big Oscar attention here is for Regina King, who plays the young girl's mother, who will do absolutely anything to protect the grandchild that is coming, and to try to get this decent young man out of prison.
Now, he was unjustly accused, I assume?
Well, that's what everyone assumes. I don't want to give things away. But yes, I think we can say that, because people who know the novel know that he's very unjustly accused. He even has an alibi. And the reason he ends up imprisoned is something that you only find out as the film unfolds. It's one of those films that goes here and then back in time and then forward in time and then back in time again. And again, the performances make you root for these people who seem very real and very dimensional. But in terms of sustaining a very intense lyrical pace, I'm not sure that the plot and the writing actually do that. In other words, when you're reading this in a novel, it doesn't feel slow moving. And here it does. And each of the scenes is lovingly crafted, and you have to respect it. But I think it's the film does not quite deserve the enormous acclaim that it's received. It's won major awards from Seattle Film Critics. We just voted for our awards, and from many other critics' organizations, and will probably be remembered at Oscar time. However, a 2.5 stars for If Beale Street Could Talk, and what they're responding to is something that that is explained at the very top of the film in a crawl, that somehow the jazz on Beale Street, led by Louis Armstrong, spoke volumes about the entire black experience in America, which is part of what this film tries to do. However, will anyone who goes to see If Beale Street Could Talk feel deeply disappointed in it? No. Film delivers the goods.
I was going to ask, will it help the push for sentencing reform?
Could. But here it's not sentencing reform, it's police reform. Yeah. I mean, and by the way, it is one of those films where the only significant white character is the lawyer they're trying to rely on, who, he's no Atticus Finch, let's put it that way.
A disappointment.
In any event, Dave, that one of the frustrating things about the film business right now is that they hold a lot of what they consider to be the best films until the very end of the year, and then boom, out they come, and a lot of them are going to be ignored. I don't know if this film is going to catch fire because there's so many films that are out there right now. We've talked about Vice or the new Coen Brothers film, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs.
2.5 stars for...
If Beale Street could talk.
If Beale Street could talk.
If Dave Ross could talk. And he does. Every day. Well.
Thank you, Michael.
You bet, Dave.
First, Hannah Scott back in the studio with us this morning, keeping busy heading into the new year. It's because the new legislative session begins. Hannah, you were behind one of the, actually not you, but Mona Doss, the Democratic senator-elect here. She was behind one of the biggest upsets in state legislative races this past election day. She flipped South King County's 47th District Senate blue to win against Republican Joe Fain, who's been in for, I've been hearing his name for many, many years. So
yeah,
this was a big upset. What do you know about Mona and coming up in the session?
Well, I had a chance to talk to Mona right after the primary and then again here about a week ago. So she's a small mortgage business owner who has, for 14 years, she's been doing that business. And she was born in India. She moved here with her parents at 8 months old. She came out of the primary down 7 points to incumbent Senator Joe Fain, who had at the time raked in four times as much in campaign donations as Mona Doss had. But the table started to turn in the lead up to Election Day in November when Fain was accused of rape, an allegation he continues to deny, and that did not keep him from coming out of election night ahead. So it looked like he was going to win for a while. But as the results continued to trickle in, there was a lead swap and Fain conceded. And Doss could not be more excited.
It was a fantastic journey and a very exciting end to the election cycle. And it feels great. I'm really honored and grateful to the voters and the supporters and the friends and family that were with me along the way.
But she admits there has not been much time to celebrate, with her diving right in to get ready for her new gig as senator of the 47th district.
Of course, the minute you win, things escalate very quickly. I've gone to a couple conferences in D.C. Preparing me to be a legislator. I took a lot of training courses on how to run for office, and I was delighted that there were actually training programs to teach new legislators how to be effective legislators.
So she went to 3 conferences in D.C. and in other areas, and her big takeaways from those?
I think just being around other legislators in other states to really start to understand, you know, what works in their states and what haven't. We talked a lot about other states that have full-time legislatures in term limits, so that was really interesting. One of the things that was most exciting was meeting legislators from California and Oregon to really talk about how we can move legislation forward together as a collective.
So that idea of a regional legislative approach is one Doss is extremely passionate about. Among the possibilities?
Well, we talk about, you know, just being able to negotiate collectively either for prescription drugs or to help combat the opioid crisis as well as the homelessness crisis that we're all experiencing. And there's a couple of other varieties that really affect our region that I think will be really exciting. The environment, mitigating climate change. We have a lot of issues that we care about deeply as those 3 states. And it was really exciting for me to really start to try to move that idea forward and what that could look like in 2019 for all 3 states.
Another thing the incoming senator is passionate about is her committee assignments. Doss landed on all of the committees that she requested that involve issues that she has expertise in, is passionate about, or that she ran on during the campaign.
Got on the Transportation Committee, which is one of the biggest issues that I ran on in our district. I also got on Environment and Tourism, which is also, you know, one of the things that I very much care about. I have an MBA in Sustainable Business. I also got on Housing Stability and Affordability, which goes with my mortgage background. As you know, I've been in the mortgage industry for the last 14 years. And then the final one is Financial Services, which really encompasses banking, mortgage, insurance, the added economic development, which I'm really excited about, you know, pushing forward and talking about jobs, specifically green jobs.
Now, several of those committees are brand new committees and focus on some of the major issues facing our state, including the Housing Affordability Committee, which Doss landed the vice chair position on.
One of the biggest issues in my area is you either rent an apartment or you have to buy a $300,000 to $500,000 house. There's not a lot of housing stock in between. And this is an issue. There needs to be more condos. There needs to be more townhouses. There needs to be opportunities for people to move out of apartments and into, you know, more affordable housing that they can buy. And that's, you know, that's been a big passion for me for the last 14 years, is taking people who don't think they can afford to buy and helping them realize the dream of home ownership. And then once you have that, you have more housing stock.
She also wants to see some form of car tab relief. She wants a plan to save the orcas, clean energy proposals. She supports the capital gains tax and has even already co-sponsored her first bill.
It is a plan to help with Habitat for Humanity and other organizations like that. Right now they pay taxes on anything that they buy, lumber, nails, you know, anything they buy to build the homes that they build. And so this plan is to give them a tax exemption so that they don't pay taxes on those, which the net saving for each person who gets a Habitat for Humanity home is about $10,000 a house. So it's very significant.
So she's ready to go. Got a lot on her plate. Really excited. And that's one of the things when you speak with her is she was so excited before the election, even when she was down several points. She's just excited. She's a woman. She's a minority. She's excited to be in the ranks now in the legislature. There were several women elected to office this year. So we're growing our ranks as far as females in the state legislature.
Always nice to get that fresh energy.
Yeah, and she does have so much of it.
January 14th is
January
the first
14th
day.
Is the first day of session.
And you know Hannah's going to be on top of it. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
I admit to being one of those who has said that, you know, if a company wants to use my personal profile, as sparse as I have kept it, to target an ad at me or even try to manipulate my vote, go right ahead. I can take care of myself. But Marshall Allen, who we talk to quite frequently, who writes for ProPublica, has explored the way that health insurance companies are using your personal profile. And Marshall, you're concerned about this. Tell me why.
Well, they're kind of taking the creepiness of personal privacy to a whole nother level. What the health insurance industry is doing is teaming up with data brokers to gather every personal piece of information they can find about hundreds of millions of Americans, and they're using it to try and predict how much we will cost for them to cover. And so this is non-medical information. This is information like the type of home you own, the type of neighborhood you live in, your income, how much debt you have, how current you are on paying your bills. All different types of information are being used. And what they're doing then is they're inferring, based on this non-medical information, how much we're going to cost for them to cover. If you're a woman who's recently changed your name, they would say that could mean that you recently got married, which means you might get pregnant. Or perhaps you recently got divorced, which means you could be under a lot of stress. And both pregnancy or stress could lead to higher healthcare costs. And so, therefore, they would consider you a bigger healthcare risk.
Well, wait a minute, though. They're not going to then target you for a higher premium, are they?
What they would say is, oh, well, this information is helpful because it allows us to give better care to people who we know have greater need for certain care. We only use this to help people and provide better care. But what I found as I dug a little deeper is, you know, like LexisNexis is one of the data brokers, and they put out a press release that they're working with Milliman, which is the largest health actuarial firm in the world. And when they do actuarial work, what they're doing is they're analyzing the risk of the population that's going to be covered, and they're setting the price of premiums. So I called Milliman and I said, hey, are you using this personal information, these health risk scores, to help predict how much people will cost for the purpose of pricing their premiums? And they said, well, that's what we're exploring. I mean, that's what we're looking
really
into. We're trying to see if it's feasible to do that. Yeah. On the computer servers of the data brokers and the insurance companies for hundreds of millions of Americans, like I would just say your audience should just assume that this is happening with their personal information. And the inferences that they're making could be wrong. So you could say that, yeah, women who change their names are more likely to be pregnant or more likely to be divorced, and those could lead to health costs. But you know what? It's also very possible that a woman who changed her name is not going to have higher health care costs, and those assumptions about individuals might just be wrong.
Now, Marshall, you point out that one of these data companies, Optum, has filed a patent application to gather what people share on Facebook and on Twitter and link this to the person's clinical and payment information. Have they pulled the trigger on that program? I mean, are they actually doing that, or they just filed the patent? And how would they use this?
Well, so they did file that patent application. And, you know, they Optum is owned by United Healthcare, which is the largest health insurance company in the country. According to their marketing materials, they have data on 150 million Americans going back to 1993. They use things like your race, your education level, your income. They connect it to your claims to try and predict how much you might cost. And with their patent application, I did talk to the people at Optum. They said that that patent never did go anywhere, and so that wasn't something that they put into place. But then I also found Optum marketing materials where they talk about their ability to link social media interactions with your healthcare costs. So it's hard to know, and I think that's part of the problem. Some of the companies refused to even talk to me about it. And those I did talk to didn't even seem aware of what the federal laws said about what was allowed and what wasn't allowed. You know, the Affordable Care Act limited pricing individual plans based on this type of information. However, large groups, you could use this to price large groups, and you could also use it for things like, you know, President Trump has been pushing these short-term plans, which do allow pre-existing condition clauses that discriminate if people are sick. Those plans, you could definitely use this information for. And pricing isn't the only issue. I mean, there's other way the insurance industry discriminates. You know, they might design plans in ways that avoid certain types of sick people.
So on pre-existing conditions, officially that rule is still in effect, that you cannot discriminate against people based on a pre-existing health condition. But what you're saying is that you could get around that in subtle ways by using this kind of data to infer who might be the most expensive patients and then find ways to avoid covering them?
That's correct.
Social media does with our personal data to our democracy and to our personal lives has headlined the news for much of the year. With one of the more enlightening interviews of the year, here's Dave with a researcher whose work flies in the face of what you often hear from those headlines.
Is social media really the enemy of relationships? Does it steal your attention away from your family in favor of an empty online parody of real life? Jeffrey Hall decided to study this. He's an associate professor who teaches communication, University of Kansas. And you looked at the data. What exactly were you trying to find? What got you onto this topic, Jeffrey?
Yeah, what's really interesting about this is it seems that every time that there's a big rise in media use, there's a panic that accompanies that rise where people get really anxious that this is displacing their time with friends and family. So this happened with television. This happened with the internet. And I would guess, you know, this is what we're experiencing right now with social media. So what this really kind of all came back to was this argument that happened in the late 90s with something called social displacement. And the argument was that as people became more connected through the internet, they would actually crowd out their relationships with friends and family and crowd out face-to-face communication. So what I wanted to study was whether or not there was any evidence that that was actually the case.
So this was the bowling alone phenomenon?
Right. So Bowling Alone actually came out right after that period. If you remember, that book was actually really hot in part because there was a concern that, you know, this was going to continue on and on. And what was curious was even in relation to the internet, there wasn't a whole lot of support that the effect of social displacement lasted. There was a lot of studies to look at it. They just didn't find it very often. So similarly, I looked at a national representative data set that's called the Longitudinal Study of American Youth. That began in the 80s, which is a national representation, a representative sample, and it followed them up through the late aughts. So the data that I was looking at specifically were on these individuals who were squarely in the middle of Gen X, mm-hmm. and they were in their early 30s at the time. And from 2009 to 2011, they looked at, did you adopt all these new social media platforms that were coming online at the time? And if you remember, this was really a critical time in social media development. This was when Twitter and Facebook really took off. And what was great about this was they also asked, how much contact do you have with friends and family? How many phone calls you're making? How many time are you visiting people outside your home? How many times are you going to like social organizations or groups? So we could look at, did people who adopted more social media end up losing out on face-to-face contact?
All right, so you crunched all the numbers, and what did you find?
There really was no evidence that this was the case. What's curious about this is that you really didn't see there being a really strong relationship between anything people did in the online world with what they did in the face-to-face world. And what was fascinating about this was there was really clear evidence that if you were a person who was very, very social, you were likely to be social for all of those 3 years. But if you were a person who was adopting new media, you were a person kind of using more media in the future too. So even though it kind of made sense that there would be a strong relationship between adopting media and using it more in the future. And there'd be a relationship between people who are social remain social. It just, those things weren't related to each other.
So in other words, well, but we must be cutting something out of our lives to be able to spend all the time on social media that we do. Don't surveys show that that screen time just in general, whether it's TV, social media, or your iPhone, has been rising steadily?
Absolutely. There's about 50 minutes a day, according to Facebook statistics, that we are losing every day to social media. Mm-hmm. If you are an average Facebook user in the U.S., that's how much time you're giving. And that's a lot of time. That's more time than we spend actually socializing with people. So what's curious about this is that time has to come from somewhere. But I would say that there isn't evidence that it's taking away from the time we spend with face-to-face conversations.
Right. So you think this is all just exaggerated, this effect of social media on relationships?
I think there are two things happening here. On one hand, I think that we are anxious about it. And I think we're anxious about this because we see social media as a social phenomenon. And some of the earlier work that I've done before, I've really seen social media as more of kind of a people-watching phenomena. So it's not as much that we're actually interacting with people. We're really just kind of watching what's going on in their lives and in a more sort of more so than you would get from the old Christmas card way, but in a similar sort of sense that people are just kind of posting kind of updates on what's going on intermittently. So I think that part of it is we feel like it is replacing a social difference in our lives. Mm-hmm. I think the other thing is, and this is something I think happens a lot when we talk about displacement. If you ask somebody, well, what would you do with that 50 minutes if you had it back? They don't usually say, well, I'd spend more time watching TV. Or they usually don't would say, well, I would spend more time, you know, commuting or, you know, wasting time in some other fashion. They imagine themselves as using that 50 minutes in a very productive way. So they go, oh, yeah, that 50 minutes could be spent exercising, or it could be spent really spending time with my loved ones. And I would argue that the most likely place that that 50 minutes is borrowing from is probably things that are other media.
Okay, so if it's not causing alienation, then are there other effects? And this is not covered in your study, but we've also heard that when you spend a lot of time on Facebook looking into other people's lives, sort of being an online voyeur, does it make you happier or sadder?
That's a really great question, and I'm glad you asked it, because one of the things that I want to be clear is my study isn't saying that it's just okay to spend as much time as you want on social media. That is not what I'm trying to say. I think there's actually pretty substantial evidence from a lot of different sources that there is a negative association between using social media and feeling lonely, feeling depressed, feeling anxious.
Jeffrey Hall, who teaches communication at the University of Kansas. Jeffrey, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
This is the Pete Carroll Show.
All right, here we go.
On Cairo Radio 97.3 FM, where the 12s hear the Hawks. The Pete Carroll Show is presented by Les Schwab and Bellevue Rare Coins. Now with Seahawks head coach Pete Carroll, here's Dory Monson.
Well, they have clinched the playoffs, and now it's about sustaining excellence going into the postseason. It is time for our Friday conversation with Seahawks coach Pete Carroll. Hey, coach, great to talk to you today.
Hey, what's up, Dory? Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you. I know you don't like talking about yourself, but what does that extension tell the 12s about the stability of this franchise and about Jody Allen's stewardship of this team? What can we interpret about your extension and what this means about the future of this team?
Well, I think some people would say that she's exhibiting really good judgment, and others were thinking that she's not. So I'm not sure what to tell you on that one. It's kind of a mixed bag right now. The jury's still out.
Okay. All right.
She's taking this thing to a level that I'm really excited about. She's really pumped up about, you know, working hard, going for it, doing everything we can to be as good as we can possibly be. And I mean, it's just music to my ears. And I think for the 12s, they should be really excited about that too. She's really passionate and she's got a big energy for the Seahawks and the fans and all that. So, and only it's all good stuff. And so we can count on really continuing to really, I hope, a great run and a great connection with our fans.
How long are you going to keep doing this? Keep coaching? What's
I'm
the plan
rolling,
here?
Man. I'm like I think I said a while ago, I'm not old enough to be thinking about anything else. Okay. I'm just working, you know?
Okay, got it. All right, Seahawks in the playoffs, the Huskies in the Rose Bowl. It doesn't get much better than this next week for football fans here in the Northwest.
Yeah, well, that's good news. And I'm so fired up that Chris done such a great job again and showing what a great ball coach he is and how he's running that program so well. Everybody should be really proud.
Let's talk about your game against Kansas City a little bit, just in the context of the Chiefs have been considered most of the season as one of the three best teams in the NFL. Does a game like that against an opponent like that, does that reveal something about your ceiling going into the playoffs and maybe how unlimited it might be?
Well, it's a real good indicator, that at this late in the year, we can generate that kind of game and play well against a team that's really high-flying and needed that game and, was playing for it and all that kind of stuff. And it's a good positive, And we were talking about during the week that you got to beat really good teams if you're going to expect to do anything special. And so we need that matchup, and we're fortunate to get out of there with a good, solid win.
I know you're very focused on Arizona. You've said that you need to go into the postseason on a real sharp note. As you prepare for them, do you change up anything when you've clinched a playoff spot? Because you do have a lot of guys banged up, and how does that factor into the equation here?
No, it really doesn't factor in because we're trying to continue to play as well as we can play. It's not about the next game or the one after that or whatever. If we start thinking like that, Dory, we're going to start slipping up and we won't be able to play like we're capable. That thinking just isn't there. We're trying to take care of our guys always and make good decisions always, and we we're pretty good at it. But this is a really important game for us to get it. I don't know who it means we play or don't play or whatever, but we'd like to be seeded as highly as we can, and we're going for it. And so more than anything, we just want to keep performing really well, and we don't want to take a chance of taking the foot off the pedal right now. We want to keep pushing.
And while I know how focused you are on Arizona, walk me through this. Do you have staffers? Because there are two possible playoff opponents. Do you have staffers as soon as those are identified who are working a week and a half ahead? Or how does that work for you?
We do have advanced guys that work on. They're working on all of the possibilities. That's ongoing throughout the season, too. So those guys just take the next step and go to the next teams that are out there and go to work on them. So yeah, that's happening. Not the immediate coaching staff. That's our staffers that personnel guys that do that work for us.
I know Sebastian Janikowski was a little banged up on Sunday, and you had to have Michael Dixon in there to do a couple of drop kicks. I know how much you love the history. Who's the big drop kick guy? Was it Lou Groza? Is that the guy way back when?
No, Lou was a straight-on kicker.
Was he?
Drop kicker.
Oh, okay,
all
right.
I go all the way back to Jim Thorpe and watching him in his old movies, he was just a drop kick on the sidelines and stuff before they had hash marks,
You must enjoy the idea of having a guy who could do that if pressed into service. I know that you want Sebastian healthy, but if pressed into service, that'd be kind of fun.
Well, yeah, I got to say I'm guilty of being, tuned into that. I think it's really cool stuff, and I don't know why. Is it the old ways, or just a guy that's so creative and just has such talent that we don't get to see, and it's just rare, And so it's fun to figure out if we can implement, the techniques and stuff that he has. This is all stuff he grew up doing,
Yeah.
So we're not teaching him anything. This is stuff that he's been doing his whole life. And I might have mentioned to you, he can kick the ball and pass it to somebody, with his foot, and do some crazy stuff. He kind of blows us away all the time with the control that he has.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. Okay, let me get an injury update before we let you go here. So you had guys who were banged up but pressed into service, like DJ Fluker, Doug Baldwin, who I know he has a shoulder thing that popped up midweek too. So let's start with those guys. How are they looking?
Well, both guys are going to game time. Doug's ahead of Fluke, and that he worked during the week, and Doug's really planning on playing. Fluke's not quite sure yet. We'll figure out here at the end of the week whether he can do it. Like last week, he worked out on game day and came through it, and he had a couple good steps forward during this week in terms of his rehab and being able to help him with some things on his hamstring. So there's a good hope, but we'll have to wait and see right up to we're just about to tip it off.
Yeah, and I'm going backwards here, but the fact that Carson went over 1,000 in that game, that you guys ran for well over 200, and you had guys shuffling all over the place on that offensive line. And again, that was a position group that was so maligned the last couple of years. And to think what those guys have accomplished as a unit and even as banged up as they are, it's been pretty incredible to watch.
No, it's a really good statement about the depth in the coaching and that it's being done. That was really pulled off well. Ethan Posick played a very good game. He played at right guard and left guard. You know, it was just great to see the guys. George did a really nice job playing right tackle in the game. And so a lot of really positive things about that just helps us with our depth going forward. And we're going to have a good group here, even coming back next year, you know, when a couple guys come back to us. It's going to be a nice group to compete with.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Pete, congratulations. I know that you say we haven't done anything until we achieve our ultimate goals, but this is really nice to see where you guys are right now and what you've accomplished. Congratulations on that, but hope we get to talk for many, many more weeks to come here.
There you go. Hey, by the way, in this locker room last Sunday night, yeah. I was able to tell you, I said, you know, we haven't been able to tell you guys done anything yet, but we did something today. You know, we made it to the playoffs and see how it's going, you know, and so that was the first step. So just so that you know, they did something. So
yep.
And we enjoyed it and had a lot of fun with it. So we're real excited about that and looking forward to a big game here to wrap up the regular season.
All right. Well, congratulations. It'll be fun to see the 12s out there partying with you on Sunday, and I'll talk to you before that first playoff game next week.
Okay, and Happy New Year.
This has been the Pete Carroll Show, presented by Les Schwab Tire Centers and by Sharp Vision Modern Lace. Miss the full conversation? Get it on demand on the Cairo Radio app. The Pete Carroll Show on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM, where the 12s hear the Seahawks.